Well, in the heart of the awakened is a call to those who are choosing to live as awakened beings instead of talking about it. And so it's the intention is to bring people together who are fully dedicated to being that. And within that, it will create a template that will go out throughout the planet. And another thing about Mount Shasta, it's like a radio antenna and transmitter. And anything that takes place here with pure intent gets broadcast out to the world.
Great. So one of the main featured speakers is Danian Brinkley. I know a little bit about him. I know that he was hit by lightning and went to heaven and then died and came back and became had all of these wonderful messages for humanity. Why don't you tell me a bit about him?
Well, he actually died three times.
Really?
Yeah, he had three different near-death experiences. His focus now pretty much is on 2012. And he's been going around teaching what he had received about 2012. He's a phenomenal speaker, beautiful heart, and I'm really, really looking forward to having him here.
Absolutely. Now tell me about Grace, who is one of the other headliners.
Grace? Grace is, she fits her name. She was actually my partner for 20-some years.
Yes.
She travels all over the world sharing her love, and she's pure love. And matter of fact, we just had a little event here yesterday where she was sharing.
That's great. Now, William Henry is the author of many books on ancient Egypt and mystical topics. What's he going to be talking about?
Well, it's interesting. When I invited him, he was really overjoyed, and he said, you know, I've been kind of caught up in the UFO circles. He said, but there's something that I've really wanted to unveil, and this will be the perfect conference for that. He won't tell me what it is.
Great. That'll be exciting.
I know it's going to be incredible. I've read every one of his books.
Oh, sure. Yeah, he's a really well-known author. Now, there's many other speakers. Any others you care to mention about this festival?
Well, there's Dr. Richard Boylan. And Dr. Boylan is going to be doing a workshop on star children. And he's actually bringing a star child with him. And he's his focus is on UFO and contact. And he's written a couple books. He's a psychiatrist, and I'm looking forward to meeting him for the first time. I've read a lot of his writings and some of his first book.
So when you say star child, are you talking about the indigo children or crystal children? Is it all the same?
Or whatever you want to call them.
Okay.
Yeah. The special children.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, so that's the first festival. It's July 12th to 15th, and it's called In the Heart of the Awakened.
And we also have Miao Ledwith.
Okay, why don't you tell me a bit about the speaker?
He's the one from, he was on What the Bleep Do We Know?
Ah, okay.
He's a wonderful speaker, and there's so many more. You know, we could get into all of them, but it's good to get into the other two, too.
Now, if people... This is a nationwide radio show, so if people decide to come out to Mount Shasta this summer, are there a lot of camping sites or motels, or what do you recommend?
There's camping sites, there's motels, there's bed and breakfast, but you want to sign up early to get your choice, you know. You may not be able to stay in Mount Shasta, but there's surrounding areas, Weed, McLeod, Dunsmuir.
Okay, so why don't you give out the contact info so people can go on your website or call you to get more info.
It's www.shalomar productions.com.
Okay, great. We'll give that out later, too.
Okay.
Okay, so let's move on to, then you get a little breath for a week or two, a break, and then you move on to the second festival, which is the Raw Foods Festival. Why don't you talk a little bit about raw, healthy foods?
About a year ago, for about 23 years, I've been a vegetarian, and I've been about 80% and 20% cooked. And last year, I went into raw food full time, and it made a tremendous difference in my life. And then there's a group of people around here in Mount Shasta. There's quite a few raw food people. So I brought a couple people here last year to do workshops, and then I had the idea, well, why don't we create a living food expo here? So I invited some people that I knew, like Victoris Kovinskis, who's famous for a book called Survival into the 21st Century. And I just sent the email out to people and got some phenomenal responses. And so July 27th to the 29th, we're doing our first annual Living Food Expo.
So when you got off of cooked food, did you feel like you had a lot more energy or vitality, or what was the difference?
Well, it was interesting. All my life, as I was a vegetarian, I had people tell me, when you go raw, it's going to be a world of a difference. And I was working at a health food store in the cafe when I decided to go raw. And after that, I couldn't even, when I looked at the food, it's like I could see that there was no life force in it that was cooked.
Right.
I could actually see it and feel it. I had a lot more energy. I didn't get tired as much. Seemed like I was getting younger.
Mm-hmm.
Just phenomenal experiences, and I don't get sick.
So the protein that most people get from meat, you're able to get from spinach and some other good sources.
I think that's a fallacy.
Really? About needing that much protein?
Everything has protein in it.
Ah, okay.
Even sprouts.
Uh-huh.
It's a complete protein.
But, rice and beans combined together is also.
Yeah, but we have the, you know, we have the industries that tell us, no, you have to have this.
Exactly.
We eat too much as it is.
Right, now what about dairy? Are you off of dairy or?
Yes, I am.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do you have a certain type of cheese or milk, like almond milk perhaps you take? Or
I make my own almond milk.
Right.
But the Botenkos, Victoria, who is coming, she came here last year and she told us about green smoothies.
Okay.
And green smoothies consist of your garden vegetables, like, you know, kale and spinach, and then you add like an apple and a lime and water, and it could be a banana, and you blend that all up and you drink it. And she researched and she found that we aren't getting enough greens.
Right.
And we don't digest them. The cellulose in the greens is so strong that we'd have to chew each bite for like 1,000 times to get all the juice out of it. So she came up with this idea of creating these smoothies. And when I started doing those, I was losing weight, you know, on raw food. But when I started doing those, I maintained my weight and my muscularity.
Now, the Botenkos are one of the headline speakers for this event. Why don't you tell me a bit about their family? Because I understand all four of them, the mother, the father, and two children, were all sick before they started getting involved in raw food.
Exactly. Yeah, and they each had some kind of different disease, and they were able to heal all of them with getting on raw foods. Victoria, they're Russian, and Victoria she took it on herself to heal her family through raw foods. And I think at first, especially the children, they didn't like the idea, but now they're incredible people.
You know, one thing I wanted to mention is not only are you going to see all these fantastic speakers, but you're going to meet amazing people from all over the country. Think of the connections that are going to be made here.
Oh, yeah. It's you know, that's what I love more than anything else, is bringing all these people together. Makes the world so much smaller.
Absolutely, but just having you know, great phone friendships from people around the country,
mm-hmm.
and then you know, knowing people in different parts of the country who you can visit is a really great, enriching experience. So tell me about some of the other speakers at the Raw Foods or Living Foods Expo.
Okay, we have Dr. Jameth Sheridan. He's got a company called Health Force. And he's got a particular green food drink mixture that you make into a drink that he's famous for.
Okay.
There's Sherry Saria and Dan. Sherry Saria created the first culinary arts class, or I guess you call it institute, where she trains people to be raw food chefs. And I think her, more than anyone else, is more responsible for getting the movement out there.
So will there be lots of tents and booths where people can sample all these different foods, or how is it going to be set up?
There'll be vendors. There'll be Lydia's Raw Food Organics is going to be the main creator of the food there.
Sure.
But there will also be others. There will be food demonstrations. There will be lectures. There'll be music. Shimshai and a group called Luminescence are going to play music. And Eric Berglund, a harpist here locally. And there will also be individual workshops for people that didn't get enough in the lecture. And they can go more in depth with someone that they felt they wanted to hear more about.
Great. And now, I forgot to mention, with these festivals, do they buy one ticket that's good for all 3 days? Is that how it works?
They can buy one ticket for all 3 days, or they can buy a daily ticket, however they want. If they can't come for all 3 days, then they can buy an individual ticket.
Okay, great. Now let's move on to the final festival, which is August 9th through 12th, and it's ET's Spirit, New Science, and Technologies for a New Earth. And the headline speaker is David Icke, who I think is the most dynamic, exciting speaker in the world. Why don't you talk about his odyssey or journey?
Well, I've come to really, really love David Icke as a dear brother. And I've watched him, you know, I've read probably 10 of his books. And what I love about David is he's got a tremendous passion, and he will take something to the nth degree until there's no further to take it. And then he'll say, there must be something else. And then he'll spiral up into something new and take that to the nth degree. And, you know, he's probably the most controversial speaker in the world.
Sure.
He's either loved or hated. And I think he's even banned from several countries. And
I have no doubt.
But he's revealed some things that we needed to hear. You know, the conspiracy stuff and all of that. But now he's taken it to a different level. You know, he's just completing a new book. And it's all about the nature of reality.
Right. I understand he's taken on the topic of chemtrails, which is very important because there's so much confusion on this issue.
Yeah, for a while there, he wasn't sure about chemtrails, but now he is. And yeah, he's the most dynamic speaker I know of.
Right. My take on it is that there were just layers and layers of secrecy all throughout our structure of our world and our governments. And he, if you read his books, you're able to peel back that onion and see what's really going on.
And then once it's peeled back, then it's like, and here's what we do.
Right. He offers good solutions, too.
Yes.
So he's one of the featured speakers. And then let's talk a little bit about James Gilliland. I know he has a ranch in southern Washington, and I've been there. I've seen UFOs from a distance. I did not see one up close. Why don't you talk a little bit about his background?
Yeah, I met James last year at his UFO conference up there at Mount Adams. And James had a near-death experience where he almost drowned in Santa Cruz many, many years ago. And after that experience, he started having voices speak to him. And that sent him on his journey. And I'm not sure how many years ago he ended up at Trout Lake, the ranch there. But he has a ranch where people come and they sit outside and watch UFOs come. And he's creating another UFO event, which will happen early July.
Right. And that's actually in another volcano in the northwest, at the base of Mount Adams. So this would be a good place to connect with James Gilliland and find out what's going on at the ranch, because my understanding is that the ETs and the UFOs would rather contact someone like him who's spiritual rather than the government.
Oh, very much so. And what's interesting, too, is when I went up there, I'd never seen Mount Adams before. So I'm sitting at the ranch, and it's almost like deja vu, because it's like, am I in Mount Shasta? Because the mountain's very similar.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So he's going to be another great speaker. And why don't you tell me a little bit about Kathy O'Brien? She has quite an interesting story. It's hard to believe, but
yeah.
It's amazing.
Kathy O'Brien and Mark Phillips. Kathy, they've written two books, one called Transformation of America, T-R-A-N-C-E, and the other one, Access Denied for Reasons of National Security. Kathy, her story is that when she was very young, her and her siblings were sold to the Pentagon under the MK-Ultra project, mind control, and she was used as a sex slave. And her mind was compartmentalized, and within those compartments were state secrets that were sent, and then she was sent all over the world to various leaders who knew how to unlock that compartment so they could receive that state secret. And Mark Phillips worked in the CIA, and he worked in deprogramming, and Kathy had reached the age where the memory starts to come back, and when that happens, usually people are done away with.
Right, they want to get rid of the evidence and start with someone new or younger. Huh?
So Mark fell in love with her, and they ran away, and they've been running ever since, really. They still can't have, like, bank accounts and, you know, different things like that.
Right. It's a hard story to believe, but then I started researching MK-Ultra, and I found out that it was a big congressional investigation in the 1970s, actually. This is all on the record.
Yeah. And I had Kathy here. Kathy and Mark came in November. We did a workshop here in Mount Shasta. And I had met her 5 years previous, and between that 5 years and now, with a world of difference in her. She is so positive.
Good.
And so full of love.
So she's been able to heal from all this trauma.
So forgiving.
Good.
Yeah.
Wow, that would be hard to forgive.
Yeah.
So tell me about some of the other speakers at the ET Spirit New Science and Technologies Festival.
We have a tremendous lineup. JJ and Desiree Hertak, famous for the Keys of Enoch.
Okay, great.
Miao Ledwith again, Patrick Flanagan.
Okay, and one of the speakers is a radio host on this very network, Brooks Agnew.
Exactly. Yeah, Brooks. I just had Brooks here the weekend before last. He did a workshop, and it was a debut workshop, which was a tremendous success. Brooks is just an amazing being who I met at James last year. And I was there when Brooks had this powerful experience with the mountain. And he came down the steps the next morning and said, "I feel different." And I looked at him and I said, "You look different." He looked 10 years younger.
Wow.
I mean, he had he's one of the most dedicated beings I know. I mean, he's very childlike.
That's great. Now, during these festivals in the past years, have you had any UFO or ET presence?
I can't really say at the festival. I mean, last year at the Heart of the Awakened, the energy was just amazing, and people were taking photos of the stage, and light beings were showing up on there, and orbs, and like Eric Bergman was playing the harp, and he had this huge angel standing behind him in one of the pictures, and so the energy gets really, really, really powerful.
Because, as we all know, we're moving toward close encounters of the first kind, and James Gilliland is working with ambassadors on this earth, so I'm thinking that at one of these festivals or community events, some tentative contact may be made soon. What do you think?
Well, I'm feeling with the August conference that there's going to be some sightings.
Right.
Definitely some sightings. It's just pulling all these people together. You know, Adam Trombley. I don't know if you know him or not.
No, tell us about Adam Trombley.
Adam's worked with Zero Point Energy for over 20 years. And his father was a physicist and scientist who was, according to Adam, he was done away with by MKUltra, the head of MKUltra.
Wow.
Through a slow process. Adam's life... If I call Adam in Hawaii, I can always count on at least 4 hours on the phone.
That's amazing.
His life is like an Indiana Jones movie.
Really?
Yeah, it's just fascinating.
So, pretty dynamic speakers, and this is really cutting-edge information. So, let's go over the info again. The first festival, July 12th through 15th, right?
4 full days.
In the Heart of the Awakened. And the second one?
Second one is the Mount Shasta First Annual Living Food Expo. It's July 27th to the 29th, and that's in Mount Shasta.
Okay. And then the last one, focusing on ETs and spirit?
ETs, spirit, new science and technologies for a new earth. That's August 9th through the 12th. And it's actually the first and the last conferences are taking place in Weed, California, which is 6 miles north of Mount Shasta, at the Kenneth Ford Theater on the College of the Siskiyous campus.
Okay, great. Is any media going to be there? Any taping of this?
Oh, yes. It's going to be taped. We're going to have DVDs right on the spot there. And the first and the last one are actually going to be web-streamed to 73 countries live.
All right. Well, let us know all those details. I will be there, of course, if people would like to meet me and yourself. I know you'll be busy, but give us the number and website one more time.
Okay, the website is www.shalomarproductions.com, and the phone number, the 800 number, is 800-319-6372.
Okay, great. Before I let you go, I always, when I talk to people from Mount Shasta, I want to ask them if they've ever seen a Lemurian. I've heard stories that there's some tall, benevolent beings who come down to the small towns and come off the mountains sometimes, and they're wearing white robes. And do you know of any of these experiences in Northern California?
Well, it's interesting because I grew up in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
I had a teacher who told me those same things, you know, about the beings in white robes who came down to this place called Mount Shasta. And, you know, 10 years later, I'm in Mount Shasta. I haven't seen physically,
right,
you know, beings like that, but etherically, yes, many.
You've felt them.
Yeah, and I have been in dreams and in meditation underneath the mountain to the inner city.
Tell me a little bit about this Telos that's supposed to be a mile below. Is that a community of Lemurians and living down there?
Well, once again, when I was living in Ohio at the age of 13, I had a dream. I was taken by a spaceship to the north side of Mount Shasta. We landed on a flat rock. That rock went down like an elevator really fast. Came to an underground city. Two beings greeted me, and they showed me all around the city. Now, there were various type beings. There were tall beings. There were short beings. I think my understanding and my intuitive knowing was that there were many different beings, not just Lemurians.
Uh-huh.
And they had their own light source. They had vegetables and fruits that we've never seen up on this earth. And just incredibly benevolent beings. And their buildings, some buildings were so big, you couldn't even see the furthest wall.
Really?
Yeah. And there were places of meditation. There was no religion or anything. People would come and just gather.
Were there humans down there, or strictly ETs?
All different kinds.
Humans as well, huh?
Yes.
Really?
Human forms.
Human forms, okay.
Yes. And there were Sasquatch.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing, because I keep hearing bits and pieces about this mystical city called Telos below Mount Shasta.
I think it exists at a fourth or fifth dimensional frequency. So if you were to go down there in a third dimensional mindset, I don't think you would see anything.
I see.
But I think if you raise your frequency, which is happening, and I think that's why everything is, you know, showing itself now, because the frequency is rising.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and we will look forward to these three big festivals this summer, Mount Shasta.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay, take care, Shalimar. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Jonathan Shalimar, promoter of three huge metaphysical events this summer. I'm going to the last one. I definitely want to see David Icke, and hope to see you there as well. So we're going to chat a little bit, and then I'll have another guest coming on at 8:40. There's always fascinating items in the news, and you know, we always have so many news headlines thrown at us. If you listen to the radio, they just throw these headlines at us, you know, and 10-second sound bites. And I've really tried to get away from that, actually, that kind of like constant bombardment of the news. And I've been going to some really good websites. One of them is right on the BBS radio main page. It's called aprisonplanet.com. And they have excellent stories from all around the world. And also David Icke does excellent news headlines from all around the world. So if you're looking for a good source, you know, newspaper circulation is just way, way down because they're simply not covering the important topics of the day. So if you're looking for some alternative sources of real news of what's really going on this planet, I would go to the prisonplanet.com website and davidicke.com. Just click on his daily headlines. And he's always got fascinating topics on his site as well. So my name is Mike Schultz again. I'm the host of Odyssey, and I've produced two DVDs on ancient mysteries. So I invite my audience to check out my DVDs. They're a lot of fun to get together with a group of people, have a little party, and they're very provocative, actually. I have photographs from all around the world, all the ancient sites, Stonehenge, Easter Island, the Great Pyramids of Giza, the Pyramids of China. A lot of people don't know this, but there are 70 pyramids within a small radius in central China. The pyramids in Mexico. Peru has many extremely mystical sites, such as Machu Picchu and Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, and also sorts of mystical sites that I believe were built by another group called the Anunnaki that used to be on this planet. So the first DVD is kind of a general overview of the ancient astronaut theory. It's called The Sands of Time. And the second one digs further and deeper into the issue, and it's called The Temple of Stone. And I deal a lot with some ancient temples in Cambodia. So So you can click on Odyssey from the main website, and that will take you to my website to purchase the DVDs, or you can go directly to fountainsofyouth.net. That's fountainsofyouth.net. You can see my picture, read my bio, and check out the DVDs. So we're going to talk a little bit about David Childress. He's a researcher that goes all around the world, and he has written, oh, at least a dozen books. And he's uncovered some fascinating evidence in South America and Central America about a lost ancient race, actually. He's found clay vessels in Brazil and all kinds of coins and jewelry that are very old in Mexico, dating back before the time of Christ. And when he went to Nicaragua, he found this giant collection of ancient statues that were up to about 15 feet high. And they were made of basalt and andesite and hard granite material. And what they had was they depicted a man's body with a bird's head. And this is a symbol that's found all over the world. It's called the Birdman. It's found on Easter Island. It's found in Egypt. If you remember the hieroglyphics of the Egyptian god Ra, spelled R-A, he had the body of a human and the head of a bird. So they found these columns and statues in Nicaragua of this bird head, and I believe that was one of the ancient Anunnaki gods. I don't believe they literally looked like that. I don't believe they, you know, were half bird, half human, but I do believe they had the ability to fly, and they did have a somewhat different appearance, and that's why all of these statues were made and left behind. Some of the statues in Nicaragua he found had a reptilian head on a man's body. And, of course, if you study this material, you do find a reptilian UFO presence in the background, actually. And then other of these figures and statues had long Middle Eastern-style beards that were not at all common to the Indians who lived in Nicaragua. So it's evidence of another group being on the planet in Central America thousands of years ago. One of the big discoveries and most mysterious was the crystal skull. And that was found in the lost city of Lubuntun. And a researcher named Mitchell Hedges, he was kind of the basis for the character in Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. He went down there and he found this perfectly polished skull. And it was examined by some laboratories, and they did not find any etchings or markings on it. In other words, it would have to have been created by some type of advanced laser or sandblasting or something of that nature that did not leave behind any markings from primitive tools. Some people believe it has magical powers and that it often glows or it has the appearance of a halo around it. And if you go online and just type in crystal skull and in Central America, you'll probably get some good pictures of it. And so the experts believe a high degree of advanced skill was used to create this skull, and many others have been found around the world in ancient sites as an example. And I believe it's some lost technology, perhaps dating back to Atlantis. So David Childress, he also visited obscure museums in Guatemala, and he found, once again, statues that featured bearded men wearing Egyptian-style collars. So once again, the Indians of that time and day did not have the long, thick beards. And the Egyptian-style collars were exactly what they wore in Egypt. And he saw a lot of animal-human hybrid types of statues, various types of dragons, and half-jaguar, half-human figurines. And I talk a lot about this and show the pictures in my second DVD, The Temples of Stone. Once again, click on Odyssey from the main site if you want to check that out. He journeyed to the pyramids of Mexico, to the largest one on the east side called Colcalcan. It's also known as Chichen Itza. And at the very top of the pyramid, he found a jaguar. And they were embedded in the jade. There were pieces of jade, and there were 72 of them. And I believe 72 is a significant number. It comes up a lot in the numerology when we're researching these ancient sites. And it has to do with precession in the Mayan calendar, actually. A lot of these sites reference the cycle of the Mayan calendar, which is 25,960 years. And many people believe we're coming to the end of this cycle. in the next few years. So another place David Childress went is to the Grand Canyon. And he did some research, and he found newspaper accounts dating back to 1909 of an Egyptian tomb that was found inside one of the caverns in the Grand Canyon in Arizona. And the article went on to state that they found a marble statue of a Buddha type of figure, and they found a chamber with mummies and all sorts of ornate glazed pottery and vases, and many sophisticated types of copper tools. Remember, once again, this is the Grand Canyon in 1909, and I've actually seen the newspaper headlines. If you buy David Childress' book on North and South America, you can see those and read the actual articles. So the Smithsonian Institute got involved, and they financed an exploration back at that time and went into this cavern and cave, and they did not really release any findings about what they found there. It's a secret. Whatever they did find is at the Smithsonian, all locked up, not in public view. But it's interesting because if you look at maps today of the Grand Canyon, there are rock formations with Egyptian names, such as the Temple of Osiris and the Isis Temple and the Buddha Temple. So that's some of the reminders of what was found about 100 years ago. And also one other thing Childress uncovered was in Oklahoma, he believes that ancient Vikings left behind these kind of giant runestone tablets of the runic alphabet. And they're very heavy. Some of them weigh several tons. And they're lying there, these giant stone tablets, and indicating that the Vikings were in North America long before Columbus, actually. And we know they were up in the Newfoundland area. But he believes they journeyed and left these tablets down in the Oklahoma area and the Midwest, actually, as well. So, once again, his name is David Childress, and I'll try to get him on the show, but he's one of the leading researchers in this field of ancient mysteries, and I recommend reading his books. He's a pretty fearless guy because he goes to all of these third world locations, and he's been robbed, and he's been stabbed, and he's been beaten, and his money's been ripped off, and he hitchhikes, you know, he goes around the world with his backpacks. He's a real adventurer. I'm the opposite. I'm more of an armchair researcher. That's how I do most of my research. But he really gets right to these sites, and it's very exciting. So the other topic I wanted to mention is crop circles, actually, and I do talk about them as well in great detail in my second DVD, The Temples of Stone. Once again, that's at fountainsofyouth.net. And one of the really good researchers in this field is Fred Silva. And there's been about 11,000 reports of crop circles since 1980, although they've actually been reported as far back as the 1600s were some of the very first reports. So most of them are in England, around Stonehenge and the mystical ley lines and sites. And then a small percentage are in Canada, in the plains. And maybe 5-10% are found in the U.S. or Africa or elsewhere in the world. So the ones that have occurred in Africa are not often that well reported, so there may be more than we think, actually. So in 1980, when we really got a burst of crop circles, they were all fairly simple designs. They were squares or triangles or basic geometric patterns. And then gradually, as the 1980s progressed, they became more and more complex. Now, the researchers went into the fields to try to figure out which were real and which were hoaxes. And they found the real ones had been subjected to high heat, as if in a microwave oven. They examined the cell walls of the chlorophyll in the plants, and the cell walls had burst. They had exploded. Once again, as if subjected to very high heat or microwaving. So that was one of the ways they were able to tell the hoaxes from the real ones. The molecular structure of the plants had actually changed. And the farmers had reported steam coming out of the circles in the morning. That was another indicator of a real one. And they were often perfectly symmetrical, of course, with no footsteps or boot prints around them. And in the hoaxes, they were generally the corn stalks would be broken. There would be lots of broken ones. But in the real ones, they would be bent at a 90-degree angle, but just softly bent, and none of the stems would actually be broken. So they also found the insects, like the snails, would have been exploded and blown up as if subjected to high heat in the real ones. So there's many different ways of actually discerning the hoaxes from the real ones. And finally, by 1991, there was a very complex crop circle that appeared called the tetrahedron. It was very large, several hundred feet, and it got to the point where they were so complex they really could not have been created by humans overnight. So the government in England began to panic after this tetrahedron appeared on July 17th of 1991. It was actually 333 feet in diameter, and it appeared near the Barbary Castle, this very complex geometric pattern. And so the English government kind of gave publicity to these two older gentlemen, these farmers named Doug and Dave, and they promoted them heavily as creating the crop circles. And Doug and Dave did create some of the smaller hoaxes, but the media ran with the story and made it appear that they were making all of them, which is pretty absurd. But anyway, Dave actually died a few years later, so he's not even alive. But the public still thinks that they're out there creating these. So that led to a two-year period of frequent hoaxes around 1992 and 93. People were trying to mimic this. But then as 94 came around, this was a period of more genuine crop circles. And they appear to ebb and flow like the tides, actually, back and forth over the years. There's periods where there's a lot of crop circles and then a few months where there's very few, actually. So another one was the Julius Set circle that appeared in 1996. And this was a very complex computer fractile. It was an intricate pattern of 149 circles that were concentric in this beautiful geometric pattern of 900-square-foot formation. And it appeared within only 1 hour because some pilots were flying in the area, and they documented the time of when this actually appeared. And it's right next to Stonehenge, by the way. If you look on the online Julius Set Circle, you can see pictures of it, and it's right next to Stonehenge. So they started to get more and more complex, actually, and one of the most fascinating ones I've been really studying this week is called the Winchester Crop Circle. It appeared in 2002, and it's actually an alien. It's a huge, complex picture of a gray alien with the bald head and the large eyes. And he's holding some kind of, looks like a solar disk or some type of futuristic CD with information embedded on it. It's circular. And it's a must-see. Just type in your computer, Winchester Crop Circle, and you'll see this alien. I did not get a lot of publicity. I suspect the public wasn't quite ready for it, for this type of complex, direct crop circle indicating ET involvement, but it's a must-see, actually. So what a lot of researchers believe is that by the 1980s, the public really needed to be aware of the presence of UFOs, but they couldn't just show up on the White House lawn. It would panic people, and there's a universal law of non-intervention. So they chose to quietly, little by little, over a period of 25 years, come forward with crop circles and make the public aware that they are out there. And it's kind of a gentle way of having people research this phenomena on their own and come to the conclusion that, yes, there are ETs, and they're sending us a message that they are out there, and many of them are helping the planet, quite frankly. And so generally, crop circles are created about 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. in the morning. And a lucky few researchers who sit out in the fields all night have actually seen them being created. And what they generally report is that these large globes or orbs come down, and they project a beam of golden light. And then within about 15 to 30 seconds, the crop circle appears in the field. So the globe comes down in a circular motion around the farm crops, and then within 15 seconds, the crop circle is imprinted onto the crops. So in 1989, a Japanese film crew was actually able to capture these globes swirling around in a field in England, and they have about 30 seconds of footage that is amazing. You really have to see it. The name of the film is called Crop Circles and Signs, and hopefully you can see a clip on the web. Once again, it's called Crop Circles and Signs. And this is really definitive proof. Of course, it never was really picked up by the mainstream media or shown on television. It's something that you have to check out on the internet. So once again, the ET presence or community, they really didn't want to come and shock us all at once because so many people would not be able to handle it, and it would be emotionally devastating to a lot of people. So it appears the crop circle phenomena is a way to gently introduce humans to this other presence on the planet. And that's what a lot of researchers have concluded. So like I said, this segment on crop circles is, I get into it in detail on my DVD, The Temple of the Stone. So I'll wind up this evening. I want to talk a little bit about television, actually, and then we'll wind up for this Monday evening, actually. But like I said, I'd love to see all of you at this giant New Age festival in Mount Shasta. And if you want details on that, go to davidike.com, davidike, I-C-K-E.com, and he has a link to the festival, as well as all of those great news headlines I told you about. So anyway, I want to talk a little bit about television addiction. It's been on my mind lately in my meditations. And I found out the average American is watching about 4 to 5 hours of television a day. And it creates a passive state. It creates a robotic type of state. It's we've really gone overboard with television, and it's highly addictive. Some studies have found that it's more addictive than opium. So I want to help our audience and help people limit television. As we all know, there are some really good programming on TV, but I found a good way to limit the addiction so it doesn't overtake your life. So what I've done with television is, the main thing is to not let the TV randomly play in the background or to randomly channel surf. That's the main thing to avoid. The best thing is to pick out 5 television shows you really like each week. Pick out your 5 favorite shows and tape them or TiVo them and write them on a list and cross it off. And then enjoy them. You know, really, truly enjoy those shows and this treat of watching TV. And then cross them off your list. And when the 5th show is done for the week, that's it. It's over. Then you wait till next week and you look in the guide and you find good things that you enjoy. So I've been doing this system now for about a year, and it's worked out quite well, actually. It's a good way to limit television. And just so you know, by the way, commercials use a lot of powerful psychology and manipulation to get you to try to buy products. First of all, they're played at a higher volume than regular programming. So that's one thing to be aware of, that they're blasting at a higher volume. And they're using, they spend millions of dollars actually with all kinds of research and psychology to play in your emotions actually and your feelings of maybe loneliness or abandonment or whatever, and they tie that into products. So it's really important to avoid commercials if you can. Like I said, if you tape the show or TiVo it and just fast forward, that's probably the best way around it. So television addiction's been on my mind lately, and certainly the news is so heavily filtered. It's really a poor choice, actually, to watch the local news, and it just leaves out so much information that's corporately filtered. And so that's one thing I wanted to share and pass on with the audience. And another thing is, when you're in the car, you know, you don't always have to listen to music or the news or a talk show. I recently drove from Portland to Seattle. It's a 3-hour drive. And the whole time, I had silence. I enjoyed the beauty of nature. And quite frankly, I call it an active meditation. It was a beautiful, quiet time. and I got a lot of answers to some problems that had been churning in my mind, quite frankly. And I got some ideas for an exciting new project and direction. So in the car, you know, don't forget to do some active meditation and turn off the radio. And is Nick Carter on?
Yep, the real Nick Carter's here.
Hi, Nick. I need you to speak up, okay?
All righty.
Okay, are you in a cell phone?
Yeah.
You are? Can you call on a landline?
I don't really have the capability at this point.
Okay, I'm going to have you...
Is it really low?
Yeah, this sounds better, actually. Why don't you briefly tell us, we talked tonight about William Henry. He's written a lot of great books, and I know that you went on a trip with him to Egypt. Why don't you tell us what you discovered on this trip to the pyramids?
Well, I discovered quite a lot, actually. I've been fascinated with the pyramids since I was about 12. My dad started telling me about them and just the different significant traits about the structures themselves and, you know, different alignments with true north and just the massive structure itself was just amazing. And when I got there, I discovered that there's a whole lot more to Egypt than just not only the Great Pyramid, but just all the pyramids, you know, the Red Pyramid, the Bed Pyramid, the Step Pyramid. There's just all the temples that are just so amazing, and I was just blown away. And just having a group like Jordan Maxwell and William Henry and Freddie Silva, he's a crop circle.
Yeah, we just talked about him on Crop Circles before you called in.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Tell us a little bit about the Red Pyramid. It's a lesser-known one. Why don't you tell us what that's like?
Okay, that one's pretty interesting. When we went down there on the tour bus, we only had about a half an hour, and I took some video going down the chamber and then going into the... I guess they call it the antechamber, or just a, more of a room that it opened up to. And it was similar to the Great Pyramid, just in the fact that there was a long ascending passage. And then when we got to the opening, you know, there was scaffolding and stuff, and people were working on the passageways. We didn't have time to explore the whole thing, but one thing that was interesting was that... I mean, it's a huge pyramid. It's not a small one by any measure. It's a really big pyramid, and it's almost as big as the Great Pyramid and the other. And there's just similar structure, and I don't know. I just feel like somehow they're all really connected more than some people would like to think they are, and more than I thought they would be.
Was that where the pharaohs and the priests were buried, or was it generally empty?
Well, that's the funny misconception that a lot of people have about the pyramids of Egypt is that, and if anybody can clue me in on anything better than this information, that as far as I know, there was never any sarcophagus or any type of burial in any of the chambers in all of Egypt ever. That's what I've, that's as far as I've gotten so far, and, that just kind of shocked me. You know, we're all led to believe there's the king's chamber, and you know, there's, you know, all these burials in all of them, and it just isn't the case. And I was really blown away to find out that wasn't the case.
Right. That's the story we've all gotten. Now, tell me about the Bent Pyramid. Why don't you describe what that pyramid looked like and what was its purpose? Do you believe?
As far as the purpose goes, I guess it's. I couldn't give you a good description of what I think it was for. That's still a good mystery on all of our parts to try and partake in. But to be honest, I really don't know about the significance of what it was for or who it was built for or by.
But there were many smaller pyramids that were built as well. Do you believe they were built by the slaves, or do you believe the Anunnaki also built the smaller pyramids?
I'm pretty open to a lot of different theories. You know, if you say you know what happened, then you've closed all the doors to any new information. So I just kind of keep it open as far as that goes. I don't know, and I don't know if anybody knows. So just
right.
To keep it at a you know, I think basis is probably better for everyone. But I just think it's a kind of far-fetched for slaves to do such a thing, myself.
Well, the stones were certainly very heavy for them to carve out of the quarry and move into place.
Right, and I mean, you just have to ask yourself, if it were slaves, you'd have to think it'd take so long, and I mean, the precision involved is, you know, I mean, I'm not sure exactly about the Bent Pyramid and the precision. I'm sure it was great, but I don't know if it would be compared to maybe the Great Pyramid or some of the other grander pyramids, but it's certainly huge, and it's definitely amazing, but I don't know. I just unless there was some type of technology that made it just so much easier for them to do such a thing, I don't know. It's just amazing. I was just talking to a friend, and he was saying that they had coin slot operated machines and electricity and fresh running water in Pompeii. I didn't know that. I mean, that's kind of weird. Have you ever heard that in Pompeii?
That's pretty amazing. What type of coin operated machine?
Some type of a water dispensing machine or something like that. I guess it was pretty primitive, but you know, it worked. And I don't know. He seemed convinced. I haven't watched the History Channel. I guess is the one that he got that information from. But
yeah,
seems like every day something else is coming out.
Yeah. Now, what about the obelisks? I understand there's about 25 of these large obelisks. They look like a tower, like the Washington Monument is based.
Oh yeah, yeah, the obelisk.
Did you see any of those?
Oh yeah. Where did we go? I think it was.
There's one in Aswan that's 400 tons, I believe. And it was never fully carved out of the quarry or gravel pit.
Yeah, I got some great pictures of that. I did go there. And, that one is really, really big. It was kind of carved out on all sides except for the bottom, and then it cracked, and supposedly they just felt it was useless, and they just said, you know, forget it. But, again, that was so far from the other sites in Egypt that do have these, that supposedly that's where they quarried a lot of the stuff in Egypt.
They had to move it somehow.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I can grasp that. That's just a little bit far-fetched, and I just don't know if I can hang on to that kind of an idea.
Yeah, these obelisks were, you know, maybe over 100 feet high. They weighed over, you know, a couple hundred tons, and somehow they moved them several miles.
Yeah, solid. I know, it is laughable. The solid granite is just amazing. In fact, I believe in the early 1900s, there was an earthquake that knocked over one of the biggest obelisks in Egypt at, I can't remember the site, but I have good pictures of it. Anyway, they have behind some rope the top of the one that toppled in the earthquake. And one of the people on the trip, I think Freddie Silva and another girl were doing this, where they were telling people to put their ear on the side of the, you know, it was a good like 15-foot chunk of the top, you know, of the obelisk that had broken off all the way to the tip, you know, where it came off to the pyramidion top that just comes to the point.
Right.
And they would just kind of slap the top of the pyramidion, the very capstone piece of the obelisk, and I could be on the other side of this 15-foot, maybe 8 by 8 foot square solid piece of granite, and they would slap it, and I put my ear against it, and I could hear, you know, kind of a bong.
You could hear it,
every time they did it. It was so amazing, and they were just kind of saying it had something to do with the properties of red granite or whatever it was, but I just felt like, man, that was just amazing how it would resonate through the entire piece.
Absolutely.
You know, I wonder, you know, what other frequency type, you know, tonal capacity the whole obelisk as a whole is used for, or could be, you know, resonated to do something. You know, I've heard different theories. I don't know if I can stand behind them, but, you know, it's just there's a lot of interesting theories about what those were for.
Absolutely. Well, actually, we're all out of time tonight, Nick, so I'll have to have you on another time, and I appreciate you coming on to tell us all about your trip to Egypt and the pyramids. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Take care. Okay, so thanks for watching Odyssey, and we'll bring you exciting guests and topics and experts on ancient mysteries each week, and we'll see you next Monday at 8 o'clock. Thanks a lot. Good night. We'll be right back.